Welcome back to Stack Trace, episode number 101. I think, Rambo, that means that we're supposed to talk about the basics of Stack Trace here on this episode. If this was a university program or course, then that's what this would be, right?
Yeah, it's Stack Trace 101. Wouldn't that be like static site generators and Swift UI, game UI development and spelunking? I think that's Stack Trace 101, right?
Yeah, exactly. Back to basics. But we're not going to do much of that at all on this episode because we just had an Apple event. Yes. So we have a lot of interesting things to talk about regarding that. But before we dive into the news about Apple's latest event and what it might mean for developers and so on and so forth, I just want to hear a little bit shorter version this time. What have you been up to, Rambo?
I've been preparing a workshop.
Oh, that sounds super interesting. What kind of workshop are you giving?
I'm going to be giving a workshop on app clips at TriSwift World, which is a conference that's been going on. I think it's been around for a while, this world concept that I've been doing, which consists of workshops online, remote, of course. And yeah, I like the format that they're doing. And they invited me to give a workshop on app clips. And I think I have a little bit of experience there where I can help people. And I've been dusting off my Milkshaker app sample projects that I used back in the iOS 12 days to demonstrate Siri shortcuts. So I've been dusting off that example, and I'm going to be turning it into an app clip during this workshop. I think it will be fun.
That sounds awesome. It's so great to have like a basic app that you can use as a playground, if you will, during a workshop, because you do want something that feels like a real project that participants and you can work on, and you can give demos in there and show live coding. But you also don't want it to be so real or so sophisticated that you have to spend a lot of time just explaining the project. You want something where participants can just dive in and familiarize themselves within like 5 minutes within the workshop so that they know what's going on. So when I do workshops, I like to do the same as you. I typically use something like a to-do app or something basic where you can explain the concepts to the participants in like 5 minutes, and then the rest you can just spend on the actual techniques and the actual things that you're going to go through.
Yeah, and this is a pretty cool little app. I think it has even like a decent design, like it's not super ugly. It has Apple Pay purchasing and Siri shortcuts and things like that. So it makes it a great candidate for an app clip. My idea is to let the user purchase something, like to pretend like this is a real milkshake franchise or something. And you can go into the shop and use app clips to order your milkshake without downloading the app. So I think that's going to be fun. And we can leave a link in the show notes to the repo. And if you want spoilers, you can check out the TriSwift World branch, which I've been pushing some commits into.
Cool. It's great that you're doing all of this in the open as well as an open source project. That's really nice.
Yeah. So when I first start a project like this one for a new thing, I start it as a private repo. But since this is already out there, I see no reason to like try to hide anything that I'm doing. I think it's fun that it's out there and it can be a reference for other people.
Yeah, absolutely. And you being a spelunker yourself, I'm sure you appreciate or want to reward people who go and spelunk your repos as well. And they find that branch and, you know, they get something a little bit hidden.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's fun. So yeah, that's what I've been working on. John, what have you been doing?
Something related to teaching and teaching in kind of real time, like a workshop is as well. I've been doing workshops for a while, as we've talked about on this podcast many times. But lately, during the last couple of months, I've been doing something a little bit different that's kind of still in the same vein. And that's to give kind of quote unquote private lessons to other iOS developers. So I've been hired by a few companies and a few freelancers that I'm working with, where I'm basically doing sessions with them like once a week or once every 2 weeks, where we just sit down and we do pair programming, or I help them review their code, talk about architecture. With one client, I was like helping this person design an architecture for the app that he was working on. So we did all that over a video call, and used my absolute favorite app for this task these days, which is Diagrams, which we also talked about on a previous episode.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of fun to do this kind of work, more kind of one-on-one, like direct kind of private lessons with iOS developers, like mentorship sessions. Been really enjoying it, and I feel like I want to do more of it, because even though we talked on the previous episode when we did our milestones, I talked about how excited and happy I am that I'm able to work independently, work for the community to a very large extent, do a lot of content, do a lot of learning material, do a lot of open source. I've kind of been feeling that I want to go back to doing more kind of client work, just kind of to create a nicer balance between the two, and to not necessarily just spend all of my time with articles and on my own projects and podcasting and these kind of things, but to maybe do more like you do, like a 50-50 split between the two. And I feel like these kind of mentorship sessions and one-on-one sessions with other developers is a great way to get to that. So yeah, that's what I've been up to lately. And of course, I've also been doing a ton of game development.
Nice. Yeah, this balance that you mentioned of 50-50, I don't know if it's close to that for me or if it's exactly that or whatever, but I think it's something that's important, and people love to say, like, to me and also you, oh, you do so much stuff. How do you do all of that? And in all honesty, mainly it's because I get bored super easily. So I need this variety of activities in my life. They're all related to each other. Like, I do, mostly it's related to iOS development and things like that. But it's important for me to have this variety in there. I've spent almost like 2 months working every single day, at least for like an hour in AirBuddy. And late last week, I had to like take a little bit of a break. So I decided I would start working on my workshop because, yeah, it gets a little bit boring for me after a while. So I have to take these breaks and come back later. I think that's a good way to see it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a huge advantage of being independent or semi-independent, or, you know, however you're working, if you're working as a freelancer or working on your own things, is that you can structure your time, and that gives you some freedoms in this regard, right? Where you could pick and choose to some extent what projects you work on, and you can mix it up a little bit. And I'm just like you as well. I like to change things. I like to try new things. I like to mix and match what it is that I'm working on, so I'm not just working on the same thing over and over again. And yeah, I feel like these things that I've been doing lately have been a great addition to my kind of overall schedule. So I absolutely am not kind of stopping the article writing and the podcasting and all that stuff. I just want to, you know, mix things up a little bit and try new things. And I might not be writing as many kind of new articles, especially like the tips and the basics and these kind of accessory series of articles, if you will, that are not part of my main weekly series, because I might be focusing on other things for a little while now. But I think that's fine, and I might getting back to that more later and try something new on the website. Like, there's so many different ways to do it, so I really think that it's always nice to take these opportunities when they come up and to try new things and see what happens.
Yeah, definitely.
But I do have a very quick game development update for you this week. Ooh. We have to do John's Game Development Corner, of course, before we get into the Apple event.
Well, there was no game demo during today's event, so I think you need to fill in that role here.
I will take one for the team, right? I will help Apple out here, like do a little satellite keynote here, if you will, with the game demo.
All right.
So I talked about the architecture of the game a while back, where I talked about how I was using kind of a controller metaphor to control the game and to run the game logic. And then, of course, I use Swift UI for the views and the UI itself, and Imagine Engine is running the game. And I had kind of a controller sitting in between those two to kind of, you know, control things, right? But what ended up happening as I was kind of progressing now during the last couple of weeks, as I was making the UI more complex, and as the UI started having more of its own kind of state that was only relevant to the UI itself, it felt kind of wrong to start adding that to the game controller, because you have to remember, it's not a view controller. It's not supposed to be a controller that controls the UI, it's controlling the game logic. So it's more like a logic controller, like I like to call them.
Mm-hmm.
So what I actually ended up doing is to introduce view models into the game as well. So I could keep track of my UI state, like the Swift UI specific state in the view models. And then the view models can connect to the controllers and can observe them and communicate with them through protocols everywhere, you know, to have nice dependency injection and separation of concerns. But I just wanted to bring that up because this is something that I do a lot in the projects I work on, whether they're games or apps, is that I like to start with something simple when it comes to my architecture. I don't want to start adding a lot of different layers, a lot of different metaphors, but then I always keep track. And if I end up in a situation like this, where I do have a lot of different states that feels like it needs its own layer of abstraction, then I'm also not scared to introduce that layer of abstraction. So in this case, I felt like it was a perfect use case for a view model to encapsulate all of the view specific state within the world of Swift UI. And then the view model can be an observed object while keeping the game controllers completely separate from that, and to then have the view models act as like layer in between the UI and the game itself.
Yeah, I think that is a really good approach. And I really, really enjoy following the screenshots and videos you've been sharing. I think your Twitter feed lately has been a must follow for that sole reason. It's amazing what you've been doing.
Thanks a lot. I've been really enjoying the game development diary that I'm doing on Twitter. It's something new for me. Like, I typically don't share so many things when they are work in progress like this. I like to share prototypes and ideas and things like this and final products, of course. But here I'm really doing like a development diary, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, that is really, really cool. And I've been doing a little bit of that for everybody too, not too much. But it is really hard to do it and not want to share what you've been working on and your progress. Because especially for a big update like I'm working on, I have to work for a really long time without really putting things out there. And it's cool to explore what I've been working on from this, quote, marketing perspective, which usually only goes out after it's done and shipping to customers. But to do a little bit of a trial on Twitter is always a good idea.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great way to kind of validate your idea or to get early feedback before people have used the actual feature. But of course, sometimes that can also backfire if you show something too early and you get a lot of opinions on it that might not be really valid, if you will, once you get the full scope of the feature, you actually get to try it. So you get different kinds of feedback, right? And you also can have a nice conversation with people, and especially with the game stuff now, like I'm getting a lot of people telling me that it reminds them of old games they played back in the day or something. And that's really cool to hear, because that's kind of a little bit why me and my friends are making this game, is that we're making a game that kind of reminds us of these old turn-based strategy games we were playing when we were younger, and now we want to be able to play it on our modern devices. So yeah, it's really nice to have this kind of conversation with the community in general.
Absolutely. But you know what else is nice, John?
What else is nice?
Apple event.
That is very, very nice. But you know what? I also have another thing that is also really nice that I want to tell you about first, Rambo.
What is it?
That's this week's sponsor.
Woo!
This week's episode of Stack Trace is brought to you by Devon Technologies. Devon Technologies develops apps for taming the information flood based on their unique artificial intelligence technology. Their flagship product is the document and information manager Devon Think, and they also have other apps such as the web research assistant called Devon Agent, the desktop search assistant Devon Sphere, and more. They have been around since 2002 and are passionate about developing great Mac apps. So let me tell you a bit more about Devon Think in particular. Devon Think is a professional document and information management application for the Mac. It helps you collect, file, organize, edit, and annotate all kinds of documents without ever leaving the app, which lets you do things like place live web pages, such as Google Docs, seamlessly next to local files. You can organize documents in groups and subgroups, you can tag them or both, whatever suits your workflow the best. Using smart groups, you can also create different views into your data based on whatever search criteria that you want, and you can also use Devon Think to archive email, to scan documents, and to work with PDFs as well. DevonThink also includes an integrated AI, which assists you with both filing and searching. And it also supports an extensive search language with advanced Boolean operators and support for custom metadata, perfect for programmers. And using their smart rules and flexible reminder system, DevonThink also lets non-programmers easily automate many parts of their workflow and to delegate their boring, repetitive tasks to the app itself. Syncing is of course also supported with an incredibly flexible sync engine that supports iCloud, Dropbox, WebDAV, as well as direct connections. And everything is securely encrypted, which lets you use their companion app, DevonThink To Go, to bring your documents with you at all times. And as if that wasn't enough, you can also run DevonThink on the web with a brand new web interface that's ideal for small to medium-sized teams, as anyone on the team can then access the team's files even if they're not working on a Mac. Their latest version, DevonThink 3, was released last fall and features a completely modernized user interface with dark mode support and much more. And as a Stacktrace listener, you'll get a 10% discount on DevonThink 3 when you use the coupon code 9to5mac-2020 at devontechnologies.com. Of course, a link, that coupon code, and more information will be available in the show notes as well. And by using that coupon code, you not just get a 10% discount on DevonThink 3, but you also help support this podcast as well. Thanks a lot to Devon Technologies for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. All right, Rambo, so now let's dive into the Apple event. And of course, this will be both our In the News segment and our deep dive for this episode. We're going to go on a deep dive into the news, if you will.
Nice.
And let's walk through the Apple event, should we? Like, talk about it from the beginning, maybe make some commentary along the road, maybe stop and dive deeper into certain segments, skip some segments. What do you say?
I think my body and my mind are ready.
Excellent. So first of all, let's talk about the intro. So this is something that has always been curious to see what they would do with now that they are doing these remote events. And of course, WWDC proved to be kind of like a template that they're following here as well. But it was really cool to see, like, first that CGI intro and then how it kind of transitioned through that rainbow gate or rainbow scene that they have there in the Apple Park. And then they did the same thing where they went through different places in Apple Park, and Tim Cook started by walking along that glass window wall. It was really cool to see, like, the whole overall production. So I first just want to hear, what were your first impressions of the event?
Well, the intro, and I'm sorry for reminding people of this, but there was this joke by Not Johnny Ive that Apple reinvents the intestine with the little squiggly Apple logo thing. And when the camera entered into a tube, I immediately thought of something, but I'm not gonna say it here. But anyway, it was funny. But it was a really nice event overall. Like the WWDC video we saw. Is it even fair to call these events? Like, because it's just a video. Like, it's not an event. There aren't people going to a place, but. Anyway, I really liked it. I think the format was nice. I still think the WWDC one was better because it had more stuff. So I think they had a little bit more variety in the type of production value they put into it. But still, this was really good, to the point. It was just 1 hour, which I like. I don't think every Apple announcement video should last 2 hours. I think an hour is more than enough.
There's definitely something to be said for making an event only be as long as it has to be, right?
Exactly.
Like, if you don't have a lot of things to show, don't drag that out into two and a half hours. So I think it was great that the fact that this was a more narrow event, both in terms of the scope, but also in terms of the time.
Yeah, and I feel like this is an advantage of the new format that they've been forced into, unfortunately, for all of the reasons that our listeners know. That they can do this because, of course, if you're going to have people from all over the planet come to Apple Steve Jobs Theater to watch an Apple event, you're not going to do like a 20-minute event and then, okay, bye. That's it.
Right.
you kind of have to make it last longer in a sense to make like the give people more stuff, especially people who are actually attending. But I think I mentioned this before when we were talking about possibly having an event this month and an event next month for iPhones. And I think with the digital format and being just a video, they could have like a 30-minute video on Apple's website, and that's it. Like, it doesn't have to be this 2-hour long thing.
Right. But at the same time, I think Apple sees a lot of power in these events, especially when it comes to the media coverage. And I think they wouldn't want to downplay it by just putting it on the website or something and not making a big thing out of it. It's like still keeping up that Apple event feeling, even if it is just a pre-recorded video, I think is an important part of their strategy. And this event, well, we can argue whether it was successful or not in being like a standalone event, but it really feels like that was still the format that they were going for here.
Yeah, definitely. So should we talk about Apple Watch?
Let's do it, because they were very clear. They set the expectations very much up front. Like, one of the first things that Tim Cook said was that today we're talking about Apple Watch and iPad. So that immediately kind of just set the tone for the event, right? No one was sitting there waiting for the iPhone to show up. So the Apple Watch and the iPad got to kind of get their time to shine, which I think was really good. So yeah, let's talk about the Apple Watch.
Yeah, so Apple Watch Series 6, I think something not many people were expecting, even though it's kind of a given with every new year, are new colors for the case.
Yeah, exactly. New colors, new watch bands, even new styles of watch bands. There was a lot of external changes or news, even though the body or enclosure of the actual watch itself remains almost identical, apart from the colors.
Yeah, and has a chip based on Apple Silicon, which is interesting that they use this term now for everything. And it's the S6 chip, and it's based on the A13. So this is a beast.
Yeah, they said it's 20% faster than the previous iteration. And I also found it really interesting that they refer to it as Apple Silicon. And I feel like this is something they will probably keep doing more and more going forward, just to kind of emphasize that all of Apple's products will now eventually run their own chips. And they're all kind of part of the same family of chips, even though they are being scaled up or down depending on the device that they're running in.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. And I think the main feature of this device is the blood oxygen measurement, right?
Yeah, I think so. The sensor that enables the blood oxygen measurement is definitely a big thing. Also, one thing that stood out to me was that they said that the display is 2.5 times brighter outdoors when it's using the always on mode, mm-hmm. which I think is really great news, because I think that was something, I don't have the Series 5 myself, I have the Series 4, but that was something that a lot of people brought up, was that it wasn't very bright in like in sunlight or when you're outdoors. Remember when we used to be outdoors, Rambo? But yeah, it seems like it's much better in those kind of conditions. Like, you can see the display better in sunlight.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this will be good for people who go outside, which, I mean, outside is mostly okay in most places. Again, check your local recommendations. Something I'm curious about, and what's interesting always about recording right after the event like we're doing today, is there's a lot we don't know. And something I don't remember seeing at the event or afterwards is, what's the availability of blood oxygen monitoring? Is that like a thing that will need to be regulated to work everywhere? Like, is it coming to US first and then other places, or is it something that's going to be available everywhere?
So one thing that I took note of is they said that the notifications of when you have low blood oxygen will be available later this year, I believe they said. And that could be the thing. So it might be that you can start a measurement session yourself and that doesn't have to be regulated. But if you're actually going to give advice around it and tell people about it, then they might need regulatory approval either in all countries or some countries, or, you know, in EU or US, or we don't know. So that might be a little asterisk of this feature, that maybe the sensor itself will be turned on and available, and the app will be available, but that the notifications won't be available until later this year. That could be the case.
I opened up their press release and searched for an asterisk, but I couldn't find one. So we'll see what happens with that.
All right. Yeah. And a few other things they brought up as well was some improved elevation capabilities, and as well, new watch faces, of course. And like we mentioned earlier, also new kinds of bands, like this solo loop band, which has this stretchable design, which looks really nice with the braided version as well. And yeah, that feels like that were pretty much all of the updates for the Series 6, right?
Yeah, definitely. Besides the new watch faces, which I'm not sure if they are just for the new Series 6 watch or if some of them will be for the previous ones as well. It's always weird with watch faces, like there are some weird availability limitations that don't really make sense, like some watch faces are only available on certain models just because, like, there's no actual reason for it. But yeah, it's interesting. I like the new GMT watch face with multiple time zones.
It's going to be very useful for people like us who collaborate with people in other time zones.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. And also when you're traveling and you want to see like your local time and the time back home, I think, remember traveling again. But I think this is going to be a really cool one. And the new bands as well. Funny, when they talked about the new bands, I remembered, I think it was a report by German, which was a while ago, that Apple was working on, there was going to be some sort of communication between the Apple Watch and the band. So the band was going to have something in it.
The band runs iOS.
or better, the band runs OS 10.
Exactly.
I thought they were going to talk something about that, but wasn't this time.
Wasn't this time. But speaking of that, like the ad that they ran later when they showed all of the features that the Apple Watch has, and it was like, it already does that, right? Like there was this futuristic parody of a futuristic kind of, in the future, this and this will happen. And all of the people wearing Apple Watch were saying, oh, it already does that. Like the thing we just said here now, where we were laughing about the band running like a version of iOS or something, I'm sure that will eventually happen. And then, now it seems like this futuristic idea. And, you know, to the point of that commercial, it kind of is very true with the Apple Watch, is that the miniaturization that's going on with technology and just the amount of sensors that this device is gaining and the capabilities and how fast it's becoming, it's incredibly impressive.
Yeah, and I must say again, I sound like a broken record, but I say this in every Apple event, but the videos are just amazing. Like they do some really good work on the videos. Both like the ones that have more comedy to them, like this one, which I really, really like. It reminds me of This Watch Tells Time from past year, which was had a similar context to it. But yeah, I really like these ones, and also the good old product reveal ones, which are super sexy. Yeah, I really like those videos. I think they still know how to make pretty videos for the show.
That crack marketing team, they're always delivering.
Exactly.
So next up was a interesting feature, which is family setup, where you can pair multiple Apple Watches to one iPhone. So you could have your children's Apple Watch, for example, paired to your iPhone if you have kids. And this might not be something that we will use, Rambo, although you might be pairing like your 15 different Apple Watches to your iPhone now. Or are you going to use this feature?
No, I don't think so.
But it's still a great idea, right? Like buying an Apple Watch for a kid and then having it connected to your iPhone is probably something that a lot of people will want to do. And it kind of furthers the Apple Watch as an independent device as well. I feel like this is the next logical step towards just being able to go into a store, buying an Apple Watch, and you don't even need an iPhone to set it up. Kind of like how iOS devices eventually weren't tied to Macs anymore. They could be set up and managed on their own. I feel like that's where the Apple Watch is heading as well. And this is another step along that path.
Yeah, all you have to do is look back into how the iPhone used to be tied into the Mac completely. And it was slowly separated. I think the Apple Watch is following the same path. And I really enjoy this. I think many people might find it like crazy, like who is giving Apple Watches to their kid or something. But I can see this not just for kids, but also like if you have a spouse and they don't use an iPhone, but they want to use an Apple Watch, you can set up their Apple Watch on your iPhone. Also, if you have someone elderly on your family and you want to have like fall detection and things like that for that person, you can set up an Apple Watch for them on your iPhone and they can take advantage of that. So I think this is overall a really good idea.
Yeah, exactly. And also Apple Watch is a very popular fitness product as well, right?
Yeah.
So if people just want to use it for fitness and maybe they have an Android phone, or it's hard to believe that someone doesn't use a phone, but you know, maybe they use a non-smartphone, you never know. So it's good that these opportunities are being opened up as well.
Oh yeah, definitely. And speaking of opportunities, I think something they are doing also to try to open up opportunities is, and I had to double check that I wasn't dreaming or something, but Apple Watch SE.
Yeah, they are reusing the SE name. It's the SE family of devices.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, there were rumors about this device, but I didn't think they would actually call it the Apple Watch SE. That's kind of funny.
Yeah, it's always funny when like the community's name for something before it has been announced turns out to be the actual name, which is kind of rarely the case. Often Apple, they come up with some more or less crazy naming schemes for their products. But this is one of those cases where most people have been referring to this mythical product as the Apple Watch SE, and yeah, that's the actual name.
Yeah, so it starts at $279, and I think what they are saving on here is with the processor, right, which is the S5, and also not having all of the advanced sensors like the ECG or the blood oxygen and things like that. So this would be kind of like a Series 5, but with no ECG.
Yeah, I think so. I think probably, I mean, we're not experts here in manufacturing or anything, but I can imagine that if it uses like a similar body as the Series 6, a similar display and similar components in general, apart from some of the most higher end ones, then that would also reduce the price, right? Because it's probably cheaper for them to manufacture more of the same components than to start up a completely separate manufacturing line.
Yeah, I think that makes sense and also probably makes it cheaper.
Exactly, because what's also funny is that the Apple Watch Series 3 still remains in the lineup.
That's such a Tim Cook thing to do.
Yeah, it really is. It's one of those things where it will probably remain in the lineup for like 5 more years or something.
Yeah, you ask him in 5 years, what about the Apple Watch Series 3? It's still a product in our lineup.
Exactly.
That's Tim Cook's answer for anything.
It really is. So my question to you around the Apple Watch SE is, who do you think this is for? Like, who do you think should buy an Apple Watch SE?
I think the person who should buy the Apple Watch SE is the one who's purchasing an Apple Watch for someone else. I think this is a gift product. I really think, and I am thinking about some people in my life who might benefit from having an Apple Watch, and I may or may not be doing that. Of course, there might be people out there, they want to save money and they don't really see benefit on like faster processor or ECG, so they can save on that, or they don't want any of the more advanced materials that you can get with the Series 6. So I think that's who this product is for. And maybe the Series 3 is like if you're really cheap or if you want to like get it for a kid or something. And I think that's mainly the gist of it. And I'll be getting the Series 6, of course.
Oh, you're getting it?
Of course I am.
I don't think I am. I'm going to keep rocking my Series 4 for one more year. I think the Series 3 also is important for the fitness aspect that I mentioned earlier as well. Mm-hmm. Like if you're not interested in some of the more advanced sensors, then the Series 3 will do just fine, right? Maybe battery life wise, I'm not sure. But yeah, it should probably still be okay. But yeah, it's cool that they introduced the SE as well for someone who wants like a slightly lower price point, maybe not the very latest and greatest in terms of the capabilities, but still a like very, very capable device.
Yeah, and I think one of the best things, in my opinion, about the Series 6 are the new colors. In fact, I am getting a lower tier, quote-unquote, Apple Watch than I got last year. So I currently have the Titanium Series 5, but I'm going to get the Aluminum Series 6 with the blue case because I think it's really cool.
Nice. Are you going to get a blue iPad Air to match it?
No, that would be too much.
Rambo, you have to think about your style. You have to think about, you know, how you present yourself to the world. If you're going to have a blue Apple Watch, your iPad needs to match your watch. Come on, what are you thinking?
I really like the blue iPad Air, though. And something that bothers me is that many times, like, I'm sure they'll update the iPad Pro soon-ish. And by that, I mean probably early next year. And it probably won't have all the cool color options. But I want the nice colors, John.
Yeah, I really like when they make these colored metal kind of things. Like when it feels like the whole device is tinted in a color.
Mm-hmm.
I think, well, we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but the new iPad Air looks great. But let's continue down the event or the list here that we made from the event. There was an environmental update where Apple once again stated that by 2030, they will be 100% carbon neutral, including their supply chain, which is fantastic. They talked a lot about the recycling aspects of the Apple Watch. But then we come to a little footnote here in the segment, which is that there will be no USB charger in the box for the Apple Watch, which also leads me to think that there won't be one for the iPhone either. And at this point in the event, you know, me and Rambo, usually when we watch these, we have like an iMessage conversation going on. And I wrote to you at this point in the event, like, this was the main reason for this event. This was the main reason they had this before the iPhone event. Because if they would say for the first time with the iPhone that it's not including a charger, then that would be like a big scandal, right? That would be like what all the news outlets would be writing about. Just like when they removed the headphone jack. And whenever Apple removes anything, it's always like big, big news. So I feel like this was also like an important reason here to have this event, to do this with the Apple Watch first, so that when the iPhone then later adopts the same philosophy, no charger in the box, then people won't be as upset about it. Or what do you think, Rambo?
I think this is somehow gonna be or is bigger than the headphone jack thing, because this is Apple being greedy at its best, at least for people who believe that. I'm not sure, to be honest, what I believe in. But you can totally see this as like they want to save those 10 cents on each device that it costs for them to put the charger in there. I also believe that probably at least the environment people at Apple believe, and it's true that this is good for the environment, but it's kind of like, how convenient, right? That this thing that saves us a lot of money is also good for the environment. So it's a win-win for us and the customers. Oh, well, who cares? but yeah, I can see it from both sides of the conversation. Honestly, I don't think this is a big deal. Like, it's not going to make much of a difference to me. And I don't think it's going to be much of a difference for many people. I know people who are not like me, like who get every new device every year. And still, they have boxes of iPhones from 2 years ago with the charger still in the box wrapped in plastic that they never used because they just kept using the one they already had. So I think it's going to be fine.
Yeah, I think so too. The cynical take here, of course, would be that if they really cared about the environment, then they would also lower the price, right? So they would say the Apple Watch, you can either get it with a charger and then it costs, I believe the Series 6 starts at $399 US. And if you're getting it without a charger, then it's $379 or something, right? But they're not doing that. So it's like you're paying the price and then you also have to buy the charger if you need a charger. But like you say, probably won't be an issue for, I don't know if it's fair to say most people, but at least for a lot of people, especially people listening to Stacktrace, it probably won't be a problem.
Yeah, and also it's funny the way it was presented, because when these rumors started floating around, I thought they would like do some more explaining at the event and like at least say like, oh, and don't worry, if you really need one, you just check a box during the purchasing and we'll for like, I don't know, $20, $10, whatever, we'll send one for you. But no, like it was, Oh, and by the way, we're not including the charger in the box.
Yeah, they didn't even do the courage thing where they were saying, you know, only Apple can do something like this.
Yeah, it was like they were trying to hide it or something. So, yeah, it was interesting. We'll see if they are going to mention it during the iPhone event. But I'm with you, John. I think I was tweeting about it as you were sending me that message. I was basically tweeting the same thing that the reason for them doing this event was to announce the removal of the charger so they don't have to during the iPhone event.
Right, exactly. Because so many of these things is all about optics, right? Or what people read into it or what people choose to focus on. You know, people watching, people like us talking about it, the media and so on and so forth. So yeah, it's just interesting all these kind of strategies at play here, which we'll probably get back to later when we talk about the surprise release of Apple's latest operating systems. But let's not get too ahead of ourselves. Let's talk about workouts.
Let's talk about it. I think someone scored the points there, right?
I think someone did. Yeah, I think both of us did, actually. One of the few points I did get from this
spoilers.
Keynote poker. Exactly.
All right, so there's Apple Fitness Plus. And by the plus there, you know this is a subscription, right? I do like that, at least in that sense, Apple is consistent with their naming for the services. You know something costs money. Well, actually, no, I was wrong. I just remember that there's Apple Music.
Right.
But anyway, most things that cost money have a plus in the name. And I think it's true for most things. And maybe they'll invent Music Plus or something. But yeah, it is a plus service. It's $9.99 per month, powered by the Apple Watch. And it's what we heard in rumors and leaks. It's going to sync metrics. So you can do it with an iOS device or Apple TV, and you can see the workout on screen with an instructor and see how you're doing. And I think this type of integration between Apple Watch and Apple TV is going to be really cool to see, and a really good use of the power of the ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. And leveraging the fact that one device has a big screen and the other one has a lot of sensors, right?
Exactly.
So yeah, that each device can do what it's best at, and then they can synchronize information between them. And this is something also, like, I feel is a little bit of a trend with Apple in the last couple of years, with features, for example, like Sidecar, where you can use your iPad as a Mac display, which I've actually been using quite a lot lately. I've been meaning to talk about it on the show, but we'll save that for a future episode. Anyway, it's really cool to see, like, Apple leveraging the fact that they have this ecosystem, they have this family of devices that can then collaborate on certain tasks to make, like, new experiences possible. So I just feel like this is a really, really cool use case of that. And in general, I'm a huge fan of connecting one device to another to gain some new functionality, like a kind of second screen experience or something. I think that's always really cool to see. And this seems like a very, very cool use case for just that.
Yeah. And what's the availability story like for Fitness Plus?
It's launching in kind of English speaking countries before the end of the year, they said. So it's like US, Canada, UK, Australia, I believe, New Zealand, and so on. So neither of our countries, unfortunately, but I guess it's something where it might come later. Maybe they want some localized content. Maybe they want to be able to add subtitles or something. I don't know. It's one of those things when it comes to these kind of content deals that it's sometimes hard to understand why it's not being rolled out more aggressively, but I guess they have their reasons.
Yeah, this is something that bothers me. Like, if it's just for the language, I do understand Apple wanting to offer things in a localized fashion for all users, but, like, there are many people in other countries who speak English, so yeah, why not? Like, unless there is, like you mentioned, some licensing thing. The thing I can think of, and I believe you can select music and you can like do music alongside the workout, right?
Yeah, exactly. They could have some licensing implications there, because even if, you know, it's connected to Apple Music and they of course have the licenses for Apple Music, it could just be, I mean, again, we're not lawyers, we're especially not music licensing lawyers, which is a very complicated subject. But, you know, you can just imagine that there might be some complications there where they are only allowed to stream the music as part of Apple Music. And in order to make, you know, the music available inside of fitness app, they need a new license, which they, you know, might just need to do some work on.
Yeah, they probably need a special license, I think, for the music, because they are charging the user for Fitness Plus and for Apple Music. So I suspect maybe they need to pay a little bit of a higher fee for the music or something. So yeah, it's probably the music aspect that's making it launch later in other places. So we'll see if this is something like News Plus that's going to launch in, quote, English-speaking countries and never be released anywhere else, basically, or if it's going to roll out to other countries soon-ish.
Right. It also might come down to what we talked about earlier around optics, right? Like where if they launch this in, let's say, Poland or Brazil or any other country where English is not the primary language, then the news coverage of it might just be, well, it's Apple's new fitness service, but it's only available in English, you know? Like that people might not be paying as much attention to it if that was the case. So they might just need to do some work to maybe some of the content will still be in English or the majority of it, but just have some localized content might just be also something they want to do.
Yeah, but they could release it and only make it available if your device is in English, for instance. So
sure,
you're not going to have like people being surprised by this weird non-localized thing on their device.
Yeah, there are definitely approaches here. So we'll have to see what happens. I am really excited about this. I actually just recently started trying to burn off some of the lockdown kilos that I've gained during, you know, sitting at home and not going out much and not moving around so much. So I am really into fitness now these days. I'm going to have a fitness fall here, hopefully, and do a lot of workouts. So I would actually love something like this right now, but I guess I'll just have to wait and see.
Absolutely. And still in the services aspect, something which wasn't like completely predicted for this event, like there were some rumors, but none of them were like sure about it, but it became a reality and we finally have it. Apple One.
You know what's really funny is that this is the one time where we didn't bet on it and then it happened. It's kind of like if you bring an umbrella, then it's not going to rain, right?
Exactly.
Like it's kind of the same phenomenon. So after we did our poker, I was like, why didn't we bet on the Apple One bundle like this time? We've been betting on it all the time since. But yeah, we missed that one, but really excited that it's here. And the price seems to be really great. I can't wait to see what the local prices will be here, because if it's going to be, I believe it was $15 for the individual tier, which includes iCloud storage, Apple Music, Apple TV Plus, and Apple Arcade, then that's a great deal. Because here in Poland, for example, just Apple Arcade costs like almost $10. So it's going to be interesting to see what the actual translation is going to be.
Nice. Yeah, one of the things they've done when they turned the all of their services, including the App Store, to the local currency here in Brazil, is that some of the prices became really attractive. Like, I think Apple Arcades, if you do the conversion, it's like $1.80 here or something.
Oh, wow. Here's the opposite. Here, everything is more expensive, which, you know, I don't know why.
Yeah, everything is more expensive here in terms of like hardware especially and things like that. But for online services, they managed to do some really good pricing here. So yeah, I'm happy about that. And I am curious to see what the story is going to be for Apple One here as well. Which ironically, it's Apple One, but there are three tiers, right?
Right. It's Apple 1.1, 1.2, and 1.3.
So you have the individual one you talked about, which is $14.99, the family one, $19.99, and the premier one, which is $29.99. And the premier one is going to be, at least from what I understood from the video, it's only going to be available in the countries where Apple News Plus and Apple Fitness Plus are available, which is kind of a bummer because it's the only one from what I've seen that offers the, is it 2 terabytes of iCloud, right?
Yeah, 2 terabytes.
Yeah, the other ones are lower tiers of iCloud, and I currently have 2 terabytes of iClouds, which I do need, and so I'll have to see, do some calculations here to see if I would benefit from any of the plans, but maybe I won't, and I'll have to keep subscribing individually for the time being.
So I've been doing this thing lately where I've been unsubscribing to services that I'm not currently using. So I was unsubscribed from Apple Arcade for the longest time. I just recently resubscribed, actually, for reasons that I think we're going to talk about on the next episode, where we're maybe going to have a new edition of Stack Trace Arcade, which is going to be fun. But Apple TV Plus, I'm currently unsubscribed from as well. And I'm planning to resubscribe when the new seasons of the original shows that they launched with, like The Morning Show and For All Mankind and so on, come out. So I've been doing this kind of dynamic unsubscribing, resubscribing game lately with not only Apple services, but many different services, just to kind of combat the subscription fatigue, right? Or just to like keep paying for things that I'm not using. So it's going to be interesting to see here where is it going to land in terms of the price? Because I'm going to have to do the math to see if it's actually going to be beneficial for me or not.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to have to do the same thing. I am currently unsubscribed from Apple Arcade, but I am keeping my TV Plus subscription for now because, yeah, it does have some really good content and I can't wait for the new seasons.
Yeah, me neither. I'll definitely resubscribe when the new seasons hit and then I will catch up with all of the other content that's been coming out since then. But there hasn't been that much, but still some pretty good things worth watching, I believe.
Nice.
You want to talk about iPad?
Absolutely.
Let's do it. No Xcode on iPad, unfortunately. Not that I was expecting it, but you know, always still. Whenever I hear iPad, I'm like, come on, Xcode for iPad, but not this time. But some really great updates.
Yeah, that's really nice. They updated the iPad Nothing. So the 8th generation iPads, I say iPad Nothing because it's just iPad. It doesn't have anything after the name. So it's the, quote, regular iPad. It has the A12 Bionic now, so it's 40% faster, two times faster graphics. It has the Neural Engine, which you wrote in our show notes, Neutral Engine. So the iPad Nothing has a Neutral Engine. I don't know. Anyway, it can do the new iPadOS Apple Pencil stuff, which we already knew. Same old Apple Pencil first generation. So all in all, like a spec bump, basically, of the regular iPad.
Yeah, it's really just the system on a chip that is different. And I found that to be really interesting, the way they presented it, because, of course, it's Apple, so they want to present everything like it's new and it's unique to this device, but it's still using the old Apple Pencil first generation. And it was interesting to see just like how they were spinning this update, which is essentially just a new system on a chip. So it is a spec bump, which is not bad. Like, I do enjoy that Apple is making these spec bumps more regularly, as we've been talking about. I think it's great that they keep the devices up to date so that when you go and buy a new iPad, in this case, you get the latest chips. Like, that's great. I mean, not the latest, but a relatively recent one. So that is all good. But it was just interesting to see, like, that they chose this segment to talk about the Apple Pencil, even though it's still using the first generation Apple Pencil on this particular iPad.
Yeah. So, and what's funny about this being just a spec bump is how they managed to spend like a good chunk of time talking about it.
Yeah, it's like only Apple can spend 15 minutes talking about a spec bump.
Yeah, definitely. But what's really cool on iPads from this event is iPad Air.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Really, really cool update. And it also puts the iPad Pro in a kind of interesting light, right? Where the iPad Air now is kind of better than the iPad Pro. It's even got a brand new A14 system on a chip, like that's not even been available in any other device before, with a new 5-nanometer process. It's really cool to see, but it's just interesting to see like all of these new technologies being premiered in an iPad Air.
Yeah, this is kind of crazy because we're now in a situation with the lineup where the iPad Air has a better processor than the current iPad Pro. So, of course, it doesn't have LiDAR and Face ID and all that cool stuff. But if you really care about performance, I think this one is currently better than the iPad Pro in many ways. And something that's really interesting about this device is how it's the first ever Apple product with Touch ID and no home button.
Yeah, exactly. It's using Touch ID in the top button or like the sleep-wake button, which is a really cool design. And it's also interesting to learn about like what the trade-offs were here. Like, I'm guessing that the fact that they don't have to include that whole array of sensors in order to do Face ID lower the price enough to enable this new price point, or what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. What we hear from people who know the supply chain is that the Face ID sensor array is quite expensive. So yeah, I think that's probably the case. And this new Touch ID sensor seems like a really cool thing, and they presented it in a nice way. You know, John, I was convinced that the new iPad was going to have a Touch ID sensor on the sleep-wake button from two things. First, there were some pretty strong rumors about it from trusted sources, but also in one of the iOS 14 betas, and I'm not sure if we commented on it during one of the episodes, but Apple introduced a tutorial during the setup of Touch ID to like kind of show you where the Touch ID sensor is. And of course, it only included like the tutorial for the iPhone, so showing that the sensor is in the home button. But I thought, well, Touch ID has been here for a long time, right? And they never felt the need to teach people where to find the Touch ID sensor. So why now?
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's a good point. And also, like, it makes a lot of sense to put it in that button, because what button are you going to use when you're going to wake the device up? You're going to use the sleep-wake button, right? So yeah. You're going to tap that button to wake the device up. It's going to automatically unlock and bring you into the device, right? So it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you go wake up your iPhone, you use, if it has a home button, you use the home button, and your fingerprint is already there, so it kind of unlocks magically. If Touch ID works for you, which it doesn't for me. Like, we've established that before. I have buggy fingerprints. but yeah, this is going to probably be a really good experience. I don't think people will miss having Face ID on this device, even though it's amazing.
So what do you think about this? Do you think this is something that the iPhone might adopt as well? Because we've been talking about the potential for the iPhone to have both Face ID and Touch ID, right? Mm-hmm. So that you could choose, for example, if you're wearing a mask, which a lot of us are doing now these days, then you could use Touch ID instead of Face ID. Do you feel that this is something we might even see this year, or you feel like this is something we might just see in the future?
I'm not sure about this year. What I think this opens up is the possibility of the entire lineup of iPhones transitioning to the new design language, so no home button. And they will have Touch ID, because what's been preventing that from happening was cost, basically. And yeah, it looks like they figure out this new sensor in the sleep-wake button, and that fixes the pricing issue. I think for the high-end iPhones, Apple is still waiting until they can put a Touch ID sensor on the screen itself. I think I'm not sure if we're going to see multi-biometrics like both Touch ID and Face ID before Apple can do that.
Right, yeah, that could be likely, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit more about the A14, because like we mentioned, this is a very interesting way of debuting this new chip, which we assume will also power the new iPhones that are coming out perhaps in a couple of months or something like that. Yeah. It's using a 5-nanometer process. It has 11.8 billion transistors, which is a very, very large amount. 40% increase in performance overall, 6 cores in the CPU and 4 cores on the GPU, faster neural engine with 16 cores, lots of great stuff here. When I saw this, I was also thinking that, you know, we said that just that it's funny that the iPad Air now outperforms the iPad Pro, but I also feel like this could be the chip, or a version of this chip might be used in the first round of Apple Silicon Macs, which, if they are also MacBook Airs or something like a MacBook, then that will also outperform the MacBook Pro, right? So this is the year of the non-pro laptop and the non-pro tablet, you know? Finally, Apple is playing my game.
Yeah, exactly. So I think this is very interesting, and I would like to see for consistency, and it would be cool if they like standardized A14 for like the iPhone and the baseline iPad, and A14X for the iPad Pro, and A14 some other ladder for the Mac.
Right, because right now the latest iPad Pros uses the A13Z, right?
I think it's A12Z, so that's...
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's a weird one. Like, it's basically the same as the A12X, but with an extra GPU. So, it doesn't have anything too special about it. I think it's like an ugly duck in the chip family. It's probably going to be a one-time deal. But, yeah, I would like to see some consistency in there, because then it's super easy to explain, like, the difference between the chips. Yeah, which I do all day, you know, every day. Like, I'm in the grocery store and someone at the cashier line is like, hey, what's the difference between the A14 and the A14X?
Yeah, it's such a common conversation to have.
Yeah.
So apart from the new system on a chip, we also have USB-C in the iPad Air. And this is another interesting point here, where not just the iPad Pro has now adopted USB-C, but also the iPad Air. So I want to ask you the same question as around the Touch ID. Do you feel like this also is an indication that USB-C is going to conquer more of the overall Apple lineup? Or do you feel like it's still kind of only an iPad thing and a Mac thing?
This is a weird one, because I thought of USB-C on the iPad Pro as like a pro thing. Like, pros need this because they want to plug in USB sticks and cameras and things like that, and microphones or whatever. But now it's on the iPad Air, and I think, like, is like the iPad Air the iPad prosumer or the iPad semi-pro or something?
It kind of is, right? Because it sits there in the middle of the lineup between the regular iPad, or the iPad nothing, as you like to call it, and the iPad Pro. So it really is, right?
Yeah. So I guess it does make sense that it has USB-C. Like, it's for a consumer who wants something a little bit extra, but they don't want to go all the way up to the iPad Pro. And currently, it's also for the Pro who wants the latest and greatest chip.
Right, exactly. But it might also just have these kind of manufacturing reasons that we talked about earlier, where if they were going to kind of drill a different hole in the bottom of the case, right, for Lightning instead of USB-C, that might have just cost more. So that might be the reason. Like, we don't really know what the motivation here is, but I'm happy to see that. Like, the more USB-C we can get, the better. I think that's absolutely fantastic. And also the fact that it now uses the second generation Apple Pencil is also great. And it supports the Magic Keyboard. So it's like, it really is. And it's like a 2018 iPad Pro, but with a new CPU, like with a new system on a chip.
And the super cool Touch ID sensor.
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, this is a really good product. Like, if you're looking to get an iPad right now, and you've been thinking about maybe an iPad Pro, think about the differences and really think what is really important to you, because this iPad Air is super sexy, especially the colors.
Yeah, the blue color is super nice. I kind of wish that I was in the market for an iPad now, but I'm not. So going to skip this one, wait for the next version of the iPad Pro probably. But yeah. If anyone is looking for an iPad, I think this is a great buy.
You know, the device that's that Chibi Studio is mostly run on is the iPad. So I kind of, you know, I need to, you know, test things.
Is this, are you going to send this audio clip as a justification to your accountant for buying this as a company expense?
It's a business expense, of course. I actually don't feel like I'm going to do this, but man, it's beautiful. And we can't even go to the Apple store and try it out.
No, we can't. Yeah. And they didn't even do the AR thing, right? That I was betting on. Oh, well. Speaking of bad news, they ended the keynote with a interesting twist for developers. For consumers watching this who are not developers, I'm sure it was pretty fun news. That the news was that the new operating systems, iOS, iPadOS, watchOS, and tvOS, all the latest versions, iOS 14 and so on, are going to ship tomorrow as we record, which, if you're listening, is today, which means that it's already has been shipped or is about to be shipped, which was a very interesting surprise. So, well, first of all, before we go into speculations as to what the reasons might be, Rambo, how do you feel about this? Like, when you saw that, how did that make you feel?
I think, like, are we doing, like, a psychology session right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, tell me how you feel. Tell me about it and tell me more.
I'm pissed, John.
Yeah, tell me more.
Well, personally, I don't have, like, any major update for anything related to iOS going out. Like, I do have AirBuddy, but it's not even, like, related to Big Sur specifically, but I am targeting like being out close to when Big Sur is gonna be out, which I expect will be in October, but now I don't know anymore. So I mainly feel for my fellow iOS developers who have iOS apps out there, and how it usually works is Apple does the announcement event, they announce the release date. And the release date for the major OS update is usually like a week after the event, or maybe like 10 days after the event. And right after the event, the GM build goes out, and also the GM build of Xcode, which developers can then use to submit their updates to the App Store. So what's going to happen this year is there are going to be lots of users downloading iOS 14, eager to check out widgets and all of the cool new stuff on iOS 14, but it's only going to be available in first-party apps because none of the third-party apps are going to be updated because developers could not submit updates for iOS 14 before the Xcode GM came out, which as we record, it has just come out. And I am seeing some developers tweet that they can still not submit, not even with the GM build, probably some server-side glitch with App Store Connect. So yeah, I think this is not going to be a good experience for users and also not for developers. And the example I used was of new features, but there's also all of the stuff that major OS updates can break in apps, like the new photo library limitations is going to break a lot of apps that deal with the photo library. I know our friend Casey, he has an app that uses the photo library, and he's been working on an update, and he's pretty mad at Apple. So I think this is yet another dev relations issue this year, as if they didn't have enough already.
Yeah, exactly. The main problem here, as I see it, apart from just the, again, optics, to use that word again, like how Apple perceives their developers, or like, you know, how they relate to their developers, developer relations, like you said. Apart from that, it's all of the things that have been going on around the App Store review guidelines, around in-app purchase, and some apps now being required to use in-app purchase where they weren't before. And we're going to talk about the updated App Store review guidelines probably next week, by the way. We couldn't do it this week because of the Apple event, but we'll get to it. All of this, like what it really creates for a lot of developers out there is unpredictability, right?
Yeah.
And if it's one thing that you don't want from the platform that you're relying on, that your business is being run on, is unpredictability. You want that to be extremely predictable, both in terms of the APIs and the stability and the software quality. You want that to be predictable, but you also want the policies to be predictable, the releases to be predictable, and so on. So you can make plans, so you can synchronize, so you can ship things in time. And it's not about, like, I saw some takes on Twitter, you know, like always, there's always hot takes on Twitter, which was like, well, why aren't developers ready? Everybody knows always that new OSs ship in September, right? But it's not about not being ready. Like, it's not like developers are starting their work when they hear that the GM is coming. It's that you need a week to test on the actual release version, right? Because the betas, they changed all throughout the cycle. So developers need to test their apps on the latest target, right? On the actual shipping version of the operating system.
Yeah.
And they're not going to have time to do that.
Yeah. And also not to mention that it's impossible to send a build for review by Apple without the GM version of Xcode, which was just released now. So not even if the developer had their build ready and felt good about uploading it, they can't release it. They can't even have it reviewed by Apple. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really poor developer relationship management here. And like you said, it's been kind of a trend lately, which is very concerning, I feel like. Like, I really hope that Apple gets their act together when it comes to how they treat their developers, how they relate to their developers, how they communicate to their developers, because it really doesn't feel much that we are partners, right? Like us third-party developers and Apple kind of working together to bring great user experiences to all users of all Apple's platforms. That's really how it should feel. But lately it's feeling more like, you know, there's just bad news after bad news. And this is just like one more of those kind of nasty surprises that I don't think anyone really wanted to hear, that it just ships so fast. So yeah, not great. But now let's talk a little bit more about why. Because Apple, they're not evil, right? So like, hopefully not. They're hopefully not doing this to just piss developers off or to be mean to developers. They probably have a reason. So one reason that I think that might have led them to do this is if you look at the rest of this event, usually when there's an event like this, Apple, they have certain products, maybe sometimes all of the products or a majority of the products that are available now. They love to say that, like, and it's available today, right? That's the classic Apple catchphrase. But they couldn't really say that about any of these products today because they're not shipping most of them immediately. Most of them were like shipping in a month or shipping later this year. Even the subscription services like the Fitness Plus is like coming later this year to a limited set of countries. Like, these are slower rollouts than usual. So my kind of quote-unquote hot take on this is that Apple did this because they felt like they didn't have anything else to ship today or tomorrow in this case, immediately. So they chose iOS because they were already talking a lot about iOS and iPadOS and things like that during the keynote. So they felt like they needed to ship this now in order to have something for like the media to cover, for something to, for people to be, get excited about, for something for customers to get in their hands now. I feel like that might have been the underlying reason, and I'm definitely not defending this or saying that it was the right move. I definitely don't think it was the right move, but that might just be a reason. That's my speculation, at least, as to why they might have chose to do this.
I think you may have gotten something wrong about the shipping dates, because I believe the Apple Watch is starting to ship this Friday. And as we speak, of course, it's already starting to get back ordered because apparently there's demand for it. Go figure. But I am pretty sure that the first shipments are going out on Friday, and pre-orders started today in the US website. So they do have something today, quote unquote, like you can pre-order. Of course, not something physical, but it's going to be very soon. But I don't see, and of course, we don't have Apple's numbers here and we can't like look at their accounting or anything, but why not, I don't know, release, start pre-orders today and start shipping next week, and then like release the operating systems on the 22nd or something.
Yeah, because even if the Apple Watches start to get delivered on Friday, they could also have shipped iOS on Thursday or maybe on Friday morning or something. And that would have actually made quite a substantial difference to developers. Like getting 48 hours of notice or 3 days or 4 days or maybe even next week, like you said, like almost a week of notice, that makes such a huge difference for developers, right? Because if it's just one day, it's like you might not even be working today. You might have been taking the day off or something. And then you don't have any chance to ship your update to be there on day one, right? So yeah, I kind of don't get that from that perspective either. But yeah, you're absolutely right that the Apple Watch is shipping more quicker than maybe I first got the first impression for. But I still feel like, do you still agree with the overall feeling that this event was, there was a lot of things that are shipping later in this event, or how do you feel about that?
Yeah, definitely. I do agree. I do agree that they had that thing. But I think people understand, right? People know that this is 2020 and things are a bit slower than usual. But the main problem I see with this is this is not like whining about, oh, my app is not going to be up in the App Store on day one with widgets. It's not about that. Like, of course, that would be great. But the thing that bothers me is that people are going to have a bad experience. Users are going to see the update on their device. They're going to hit install. And there's going to be problems with their apps. I know there are many people who have been running iOS 14 for a long time. There's the public beta and things like that. And it is fine. Like, it's not like it's super broken or anything, but apps break, like third-party apps break. I think Pokemon Go is still not working on iOS 14. I have friends who play Pokemon Go and they are not super tech-savvy people. So they're going to come ask me, why is Pokemon Go not working anymore? And I'll have to explain to them why Pokemon Go is not running anymore. And this happens with all types of apps. So yeah, it's a bummer.
Yeah, it really is. Because one thing we've been really enjoying in the iOS developer ecosystem forever almost is really, really strong upgrade numbers, right? Where yeah. you can kind of assume you can support the latest minus one, so iOS 14 and 13, for example, now this year, and you can cover like 99% of the user base because Apple users tend to upgrade very quickly. And if this will happen, like you say, if a lot of apps will crash because they haven't had a chance to submit the update using the GM because they only got 24 hours, then that will be a bad experience for users, and it might make users choose to not upgrade as quick next time, which, you know, hurts the overall ecosystem. So yeah, I really hope they had a good reason for this, because it feels like a pretty terrible decision, both for developers, for users, and kind of overall. But yeah, let's hope they had a good reason for it at least.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. And of course, we'll never know.
Exactly. But we'll cover the story, of course, and see what's going to happen on the next episode as well. And if you want us to follow up on anything specifically, then feel free to tweet us with the hashtag AskStackTrace. We are planning a little bit longer AskStackTrace segment for next week. So we would absolutely love to hear your questions around either this particular thing or anything else that Apple announced, or iOS 14 and so on and so forth. So please do send us your questions. Before we sign off on this episode, we have one more thing that we need to talk about, Rambo. Mm. And I've been saving this for last because honestly, I'm not very much looking forward to this segment. We're going to talk about our poker results. And you can probably tell there that, well, didn't go great for me this time around. But you know, I'm also happy for you that it went really, really well for you. So the final results around our poker that we played on the last episode was that Rambo, he got 24 points. Ooh. Very, very great. I think the only minus points you got was for AirTags, that we both betted on that AirTags would officially be introduced, and they were not in this event. But for the rest of the things, I think you got all the points. So nice. 24 points, really, really good score. Congrats, Rambo.
Nice. And how many did you get?
Let's not talk about that. Let's just talk about that you won. It's great. We can move on. I got anything from 23 and below. Let's just leave it at that.
23 and below, including below zero, right?
Including minus six, which is what I actually got. Oh. Yeah, it wasn't a great keynote for me in terms of my poker results, but you know me, I'm not a gambler in real life, but I am a gambler in our poker game, and this time it didn't pay off. Last time it didn't pay off either, so it's kind of a bad trend here for me, but I'm hoping to gain it back in the iPhone keynote. I'll be back for my revenge, Rambo. We're going to have a battle, and hopefully this time I will win.
Well, there will be one fairly soon, hopefully.
Yeah, so there will be a chance for me to redeem myself so I don't have to, you know, quit podcasting forever. That would be a shame, right?
Definitely.
All right. So like we mentioned, we still have a lot of things we want to talk about. We're going to hopefully do an extended Ask StackTrace segment next week. So feel free to send us your questions. We would love to hear them. Just tweet with the hashtag AskStackTrace. We're going to talk about the new App Store review guidelines. I have some game things to talk about. Apple Arcade. There's a lot of things to talk about. So stay tuned for next week's episode. Feel free to also share the show with a friend if you enjoy StackTrace. Just maybe recommend it to somebody who might also enjoy it. Or just tell us on Twitter if you like the show. Give us any feedback. We'd love to hear from you. So that's it for this episode. We just have to thank our great sponsor for this episode, Devon Think, for making it possible. But apart from that, thanks so much for listening, and say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.